The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time, again, is August 2/August 9, 2021. It's called Rethinking Work. We've already read some of this issue, so I've chosen some more articles, and we may actually also delve into The World's Greatest Places 2021. That is, of course, according to Time. Time is superimposed in large white block letters upon this collage that features 245 times 245, about 25 help wanted, now hiring, help needed signs posted in various formats. Hiring now is attached to a window. Help wanted is on a blackboard. A woman is wearing a big button that says, "We are hiring." And there's a man looking at his computer screen where the heading in very large print says Help Wanted, with lots of entries following that. And the lower left-hand corner features my favorite. It's a bakery case, glass enclosed with two shelves, and there are trays with donuts on them. And there's a sign taped to the bakery cabinet window that says Help Wanted in large red block letters. Moving on then to the text within Time Magazine, under the heading, The Brief World. China's herd of wandering elephants, maybe climate change migrants, by Charlie Campbell, Shanghai. There's an aerial photo of a rather small herd of elephants, actually. There are seven, including a juvenile. It looks like they're grazing in a rather brushy area, and most of the brush looks brown to me, with a few green shoots surviving. The caption reads, "The roving herd in China's southwestern Yunnan province, June 20. It is a wildlife expedition that has captivated the globe. A herd of 15 rogue elephants trekking more than 300 miles from their home in Xishuangbanna National Nature Reserve near China's border with Laos. On their journey, they have pilfered from grain stores, scoffed mountains of corn and pineapples, caused over $1 million of damage as they amble slowly through farmland and villages. The elephants' antics have been highly engaging. Millions across China and all around the world have followed 24-hour live streams shot by a dozen swarming drones. One popular stream showed a calf trying to clamber out from under a snoozing adult during a group nap. Another calf trying to drink water plunged headfirst into a pond. Particularly popular footage showed some of the herd appearing drunk after feasting on fermented grain. The herd's odyssey began in March last year, when 16 elephants were seen moving from the reserve. Within a month, they had reached Yuanjiang County, about 230 miles north of their starting point. Nobody's clear why the herd set out on this unprecedented trek. Some suggest environmental degradation may have spurred them. Others believe they are simply lost. Professor Josh Plotnick, an expert in elephant psychology at Hunter College, City University of New York, tells Time they likely left because of habitat loss and increasing human disturbance, which may have led to decreasing availability of food and water. Elephants can eat 200 kilograms or 440 pounds of food every day, and much of their traditional habitat near Xishuangbanna has been turned over to rubber plantations. The individual personalities of the elephants in this group may have contributed to their decision to leave, says Plotnick. It's also likely that once the elephants got a taste for high-quality food, readily available in crop fields such as sugarcane, they continued to seek it out. The herd's viral fame has brought a greater awareness of environmental problems to a nation that, despite great strides, remains the world's worst polluter. Conservationists are now trying to leverage that to ensure real change can come from the elephant's plight, not least as they appear to be heading toward the city of Kunming, where China's hosting a UN biodiversity conference in October. Human-wildlife coexistence has already been added to its agenda. We cannot ignore the effect of rapid development of the local economy on the loss of wildlife habitat, Professor Zhang Li, a renowned expert on Asian elephant migration at Beijing Normal University, wrote on his Weibo page, "Clear waters and green mountains are as valuable as mountains of gold and silver. A healthy and complete ecosystem is the cornerstone of sustainable economic development." Environmentalists are also calling for the Chinese government to set up dedicated elephant nature reserves, like the successful ones created for pandas and snow leopards. Given that the price of rubber is extremely low, buying back land from farmers is also a possibility. China's wild elephants have doubled in number to more than 300 since the 1990s, but their habitat has shrunk by nearly two-thirds over the same period. Though China has extremely harsh penalties for those caught killing elephants, the combination of these factors means the potential for human-elephant conflict will only rise. "We hope elephants can recover their populations in their historic range," Becky Xu Chen from the IUCN Asian Elephant Specialist Group told state broadcaster CGTN, "but it is extremely challenging for them to coexist with people. The big fear is that the intensity of conflict between humans and elephants can start as just a nuisance and quickly grow to the point where people or elephants get killed," says Plotnick. "This is already happening in some countries in Asia and spells a dire future for elephants if we do not reverse the trend." The brief news page also includes some milestones. Beginning, though, with the brief news under Nation, Chauvin prosecutors have new eyes on 2013 case by Carl Vick, Minneapolis, with reporting by Mariah Espada. The prosecutors who won a conviction for the murder of George Floyd say they're focused anew on the case of a young black man killed by Minneapolis police in 2013. Terrence Franklin was 22 when he was shot 10 times, 5 in the head, by SWAT officers in a confrontation that Franklin's family called an execution. The officers were initially cleared of wrongdoing. In June, Time detailed evidence that had moved the Minneapolis City Council in 2020 to settle the family's wrongful death lawsuit, including a bystander recording that allegedly captured an officer shouting, "Come out, little N. space, 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 R. Don't go putting those hands up now," shortly before Franklin was shot. When I read the article, I was utterly shocked and appalled, says Keith Ellison, the Minnesota Attorney General whose office led the prosecution of former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin in Floyd's murder. Interviewed July 15 outside a Northwest Minneapolis coffee shop, where he was interrupted often by well-wishers, Ellison said, "I don't know all the evidence. I have not even listened to the tape, but I was like, wow, wow." Back in 2013, the Minneapolis Police Department, MPD, swiftly cleared its officers, who claimed Franklin, a burglary suspect, was killed immediately after seizing an officer's gun and wounding two of the five SWAT team members who confronted him in a crowded basement. The department ignored the video recorded by a bystander, the murky audio of which appears to indicate Franklin was captured and showered with racial epithets before being killed, not shot down in self-defense. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman has asked a state agency, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, BCA, to investigate the recording as well as other evidence gathered for the family's lawsuit. Some of the stuff is kind of surprising and intriguing, Freeman tells Time. The statute of limitations never runs out on homicides. So if I have new evidence, new reliable evidence, I can reopen the case and look at it again. I do not have that yet. This needs to be investigated. I mean, Terrence Franklin troubled me, Freeman adds. The case troubles me. Freeman was also the local prosecutor in 2013 and effectively cleared the five officers by taking the MPD's investigation to a grand jury, which declined to indict. In a June 14 interview, he noted the MPD no longer investigates itself and that grand juries, which operate in secret, no longer get police shootings. Freeman now makes the charging calls himself. "I like to think we have learned some lessons," he says. "If you saw the difference between the evaluation on Franklin and what we presented to the jury in Chauvin, I mean..." Ellison's state office took the lead on Chauvin after activists decried the initial handling of the case by Freeman. Already awash in criticism for declining to charge two Minneapolis officers in the 2015 death of another black man, Jamar Clark. But Freeman's office was an equal partner in the Chauvin trial, and Ellison and Freeman, fellow Democrats who speak well of each other, say they've discussed the Franklin case. If the BCA confirms what Freeman calls new evidence, he will face the delicate task of confronting the police department that brings most of his cases. But he could also pass the case to Ellison, who says, "Some of these old cases need to be looked at. Some of these old cases are just appalling facts that need to be investigated, like Terrence Franklin. I have never prosecuted a cop," the Attorney General adds, "ever. I prosecute criminals. That's who I prosecute. And if you have any doubt about it, ask the jury who was on the Chauvin case." A photo here of Minnesota A.G. Ellison, a light-colored black man with short black hair, some facial hair, very neatly trimmed. He's wearing glasses, a dark gray or black suit, white shirt, and gray striped tie. Beneath the milestones column, we have 2, 4, 6, 8 entries, plus more on the next page. Died Kurt Vestergaard, the Danish cartoonist whose 2005 cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad offended Muslims around the world at 86, his family said July 18. Hospitalized Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, July 14. After more than a week of persistent hiccups, following a successful intestinal procedure, he was released July 18. Juan, that's W-O-N, Slovenian cyclist Tadej Pogačar's second straight Tour de France title, July 18. Graduated, the first woman to complete the U.S. Navy's Special Warfare Training Program, which supports Navy SEALs and other elite teams, July 15, and the woman's name is not mentioned. Sentenced, Florida man Paul Hodgkins, to 8 months in prison, July 19, the first person convicted of a felony for the January 6 attack to be sentenced. Selected, the Australian city of Brisbane as host of the 2032 Olympic Games, the International Olympic Committee announced July 21. Released, Guantanamo Bay detainee Abdul Latif Nasser, who was never charged with a crime, July 19, after 19 years of confinement. Nasser's the first detainee transferred out of the prison under the Biden administration. Launched, Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, into space, July 20, for a 10-minute flight aboard a rocket built by his company, Blue Origin. More milestones. Died Gloria Richardson. This item is written by Josiah Bates. There are many leaders from the civil rights era who remain all too often overlooked, despite their work carrying significant weight in the fight for racial equality. Gloria Richardson, who died July 16 at 99, is one such figure. Richardson was heavily involved in civil rights activism in the city of Cambridge, Maryland, where she was captured in an iconic photograph pushing away a rifle in the hands of a National Guardsman during a 1963 sit-in protest, and helped organize demonstrations championing issues like housing, jobs, and health care access for the black community. She's often been credited as the first woman to lead an extended grassroots movement outside the Deep South. Racism is ingrained in this country, Richardson told the Washington Post in 2020. We marched until the governor called martial law. That's when you get their attention. Otherwise, you're going to keep protesting the same thing another 100 years from now. And the photo of Richardson in a crowd pushing away a guardsman's rifle is shown. It's in black and white, and it's very small. She's surrounded by mostly men, it appears, mostly people of color, not entirely. She looks young and slight in this photo. She's wearing a white shirt and darker slacks with short hair, and she is serious-looking. Died Biz Markie, that's B-I-Z space Markie, M-A-R-K-I-E, euphoric hip-hop iconoclast by Ice-T, as told to Andrew R. Chow. In 1988, I went on my first big national tour, the Dope Jam Tour. Biz Markie and I shared a tour bus for like 100 shows. When you're on a tour bus and you've got two crews on there, you're going to either become friends or go to war. Biz and I, we became like brothers out there on the road. Biz, who died July 16 at 57, was always a comedian doing something that would keep everybody in stitches, singing Benny and the Jets and his renditions of many other songs. Every time we went into town, Biz would run to the mall and buy new clothes. By the end of the tour, there was a bunk overrun with his dirty clothes. He kept fresh that way. In the golden age of hip-hop, Biz Markie stood apart from everybody. Nobody's style, nobody's stage presence was close. He'd create his own way of rhyming that was just so funky and fluid. You have to be really good to rap that abstract and keep it on beat. And he was a beatboxer on top of it. He laid on so many layers of what hip-hop could be for the future. Now you see all these artists who are way out. But it was Biz who set that trend of being out there and still being hardcore and respected by everybody in the game. The hip-hoppers in my era would always ask, "Who would you not want to go on after?" We all know who had a show that could just destroy the crowd. Biz was known for that. Meanwhile, if I had to go on stage and then Biz went on after me, He would probably just rip my whole show apart. And our final milestone column is entitled Ended, Judge Judy, by Nancy Grace. Long on brains and short on pretense, Judge Judy Scheindlin has presided over her eponymous courtroom drama for more than two decades. While most judges are seen as living in cloistered ivory towers, Scheindlin, that's S-H-E-I-N-D-L-I-N, is right there in the trenches. She's a jurist people understand, respect, and love. Both the icon herself and her show have resonated so widely because of Scheindlin's authenticity and her steadfast belief people should be held accountable for their actions. Judge Judy has consistently topped first-run syndication ratings. Forbes named Scheindlin the highest-grossing TV host in the world in 2018. Scheindlin's TV fame came after a long career as a prosecutor and family court judge in New York City, and it does not surprise me she's not slowing down now. Judge Judy's final original episode, which aired July 23, may mark the end of her second act, but with a new streaming series, Judy Justice, set to debut in the fall, I'm prepared to be dazzled by Scheindlin's third. The author of this little column, Nancy Grace, is a New York Times best-selling author, publisher of CrimeOnline.com, and host of Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on Fox Nation and Sirius XM. The Brief Technology: How One Company Refused to Let Cyber Attackers Win, by Patrick Lucas Austin. In March 2019, the day after Hilde Merete Åsheim was appointed CEO of Norsk Hydro, an aluminum and renewable energy production company that produces enough energy in Norway for 900,000 homes per year, she received a call at 4 a.m. "We are under a severe cyber attack. You have to come to work," Åsheim recalls a colleague on the other end of the line telling her. "This is not a drill." Critical infrastructure systems around the globe have become a favorite target of hacker organizations. Last May's attack on Colonial Pipeline, a major oil provider on the east coast of the U.S., showed not only how brittle corporate cybersecurity standards can be, but also that integral businesses can potentially be extorted into paying ransoms. Colonial Pipeline paid the attackers $4.4 million, though much of the money was later recovered by the U.S. government. By paying a ransom, offers no assurance that a victim organization will regain access to their data or have their stolen data returned, says Eric Goldstein, Executive Assistant Director for Cybersecurity at the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, which assists companies caught up in ransomware incidents. Ransomware is a criminal economy, and as long as victims are paying ransom, we can expect these criminal groups to be further incentivized to conduct ongoing attacks. The attack against Hydro infected its global network of nearly 3,000 computers and encrypted key areas of the company's IT network. It stalled production in most of its manufacturing facilities, but paying the hackers to regain access could have left the company with a compromised system and receptive to another attack. "There was never the option to pay any ransom," says Åsheim, "so Hydro shut down its network and took up the task of removing the virus from the equation altogether." Hydro switched over to manual operations for its most critical systems, relying on pen and paper and faxes to track its manufacturing and finances, printed order forms, sticky notes on doors, and blank computer screens. Hours of manual labor and bookkeeping helped keep the most essential orders fulfilled until computer access could be restored partially for mission critical work. Manual production is by no means an optimal solution, but it's better than a full shutdown of production facilities. Still, the incident cost Hydro an estimated $70 million, according to its 2019 fourth quarter earnings report. To combat the attackers, meanwhile, Hydro CIO Jo De Vlieger, along with agencies including Microsoft Cybersecurity Response Team and the Norwegian National Cybersecurity Center, set up teams to investigate the virus corruption and rebuild the network. That meant inspecting the accounts of more than 30,000 employees and even more service accounts. Essential systems like manufacturing-specific software had to be rebuilt over the course of about 3 weeks, restarting other systems, including the company's user directory, took as long as 3 months. Rob Lee, CEO of cybersecurity firm Dragos, D-R-A-G-O-S, praised Hydro's handling of the situation. "It was just extraordinarily transparent. If you are impacting the public or the supply chain, it helps quell a lot of concerns, and it is just really a good practice. Still, with the risk to the actual hackers being minimal, no one was arrested for the Hydro attack, and ransom payouts rising, it is a constant effort to stay ahead. If a competent hacker really wants to get into a company, they will succeed no matter what," says De Vlieger. "We need to be perfect all the time. They just need to be lucky once, and sooner or later, they might be lucky again." The risk report: China and the U.S. wrestle for control over cyberspace, by Ian Bremmer. On July 19, the White House accused the Chinese government of supporting a hacking operation revealed in March targeting Microsoft Exchange server software. The view from the U.S. intelligence community is that Chinese state security played a role in illegally accessing mail services, that's email services, on a server used by governments and some of the world's biggest companies, including military contractors. The Biden administration also accuses China of hiring criminal contract hackers who carry out both state-sponsored activities and cybercrime. Though the administration's response does not appear to include the sorts of sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, a far less important commercial rival than China, its statement featured considerably stronger language about China's pattern of irresponsible and destabilizing behavior in cyberspace, behavior unworthy of a country with pretensions to global leadership. The White House knows that comment will draw a prickly response from Chinese officials. Unlike Donald Trump, President Biden showed up for this fight with China, backed by lots of friends. In fact, Washington has the backing of every member of the G7 and NATO, a group that includes nations traditionally reluctant to criticize the Chinese government too aggressively. These allies are mostly unwilling to contemplate sanctions against China, at least at this point, and the EU says only that the latest attacks came from Chinese territory, rather than explicitly calling them state-backed. But the White House statement made the point that the Biden administration is working actively toward a common cyber approach. There's no question that the joint statements from the EU, UK, Japan, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand will confirm Chinese suspicions that Biden means to divide Europe and allies from China where possible, and to build broad technology alliances with an eye to confronting China's bid to set new rules in cyberspace. Cyber espionage is a fast-growing threat among the world's most powerful countries. Each government knows that an attack on the critical infrastructure of another invites retaliation. China can attack the U.S., but its leaders know the U.S. can hit back. That is why most of the action in cyberspace among cyber-sophisticated nations is focused on stealing secrets and intellectual property. The bad news is that there are no enforceable rules that limit a government's ability to share its cyber tools with outside actors like hackers. The ransomware charge that the Biden administration has leveled at China is serious. In 2020 alone, the total known cost of cybercrime was over $1 trillion in global losses, more than double the cost in 2018. Hospitals have also faced a surge in ransomware attacks. For now, no warning from Washington, coordinated with allies or not, will halt Chinese hacking operations. The scale of cyber threats is growing, and Biden has not found the right combination of carrots and sticks to make much difference. The administration promises further actions to hold China accountable. That leaves future sanctions on the table. For now, the Chinese have lost significant face. They will respond with statements that remind Washington and the world that the U.S. does not always behave responsibly in cyberspace either. Beijing will also threaten some of the other countries that joined the U.S. condemnation, including by warning of less access to the Chinese marketplace for their companies. The clear message from all this is that the U.S.-China rivalry is escalating, and no one has yet figured out a way to slow the momentum. The leadership brief. This is a short column by Eben Shapiro entitled The Meat Problem. Ethan Brown, the chief executive officer of Beyond Meat, a leading player in plant-based meat, believes the drought in the American West will help raise awareness of the climate impact of what we eat. Says Brown, "I cannot help but hope that people are drawing the connection between the temperatures they are feeling and the drought that is occurring and their food choices, particularly the center-of-the-plate protein. I spent the weekend with my son and his high school basketball team outside Phoenix, and it was so hot that homeless people were on the edge of the road begging for cold water. It was out of some sort of apocalyptic scene. For agricultural practices that are heavily reliant on water and the inefficient use of water, there has to be a change. And I think people are starting to realize that. Still, Brown is cognizant that people have strong feelings about beef. It is a difficult thing to tell someone that what they're eating and what they're doing may not be the best thing. The consumption of meat is so ingrained in our society, and it is so tightly tied to perceptions of who we are." The View, a strange graphic here, heads this article. It looks like a person. Now, this is almost Picasso-esque in terms of its graphic aspects. It's a black couch or sofa, and it looks like two people are reclining on it, and they're very geometric. It's as if they're drawn in white chalk with a head at either end of this piece of furniture. And in the middle, I see a lot of squares and X's and stripes. So it's difficult to say exactly what it is. But I can tell you that this piece of furniture is sitting on kind of a robin's egg blue surface with an orange cat, very clearly an orange cat, curled up beneath it. This is The View, Society, A Pandemic Experiments with Human Relations, by Belinda Luscombe. The past 16 months have served as perhaps the largest and longest study period for the effects of isolation on relationships. Could digital communication replace human-to-human contact? How do couples cope with stressful events they've never before encountered? Would some types of unions flourish while others wither? Around the world, social scientists have reviewed and analyzed the data. hear some of what we've learned so far. Six paragraphs follow. Gender roles in the home got more, not less defined. A study out of New Zealand found that during the stay-at-home measures, with people working at home and schools closed, each partner in heterosexual relationships took on more household duties. But women took on many more. While both men and women recognized the situation was imbalanced, it only led to relationship dissatisfaction among the women, unless the men were doing a lot of child care. Contrary to expectations, lonely people who wanted a partner did not lower their standards. Using a multinational survey of almost 700 single people, most of them women, a group of researchers found that single people were more interested in finding a partner when they were more worried about COVID-19. The researchers expected those people to lower their standards given the exigent circumstances. They did not, not even about looks. People who don't like video chat ignored lockdown orders. Getting together via video took off during the lockdown, with workplaces and families having to quickly adapt to meeting over Zoom or other platforms. A Utah State University study found that those who had difficulty adjusting to this were more likely to violate social distancing protocols and pleas to avoid gatherings and go see friends and family. The need for connection was stronger than the fear of infection. Same-sex couples who avoided fighting were less happy than those who voiced their complaints. In a study of LGBTQ couples, those who refrained from complaining about their relationships when something was wrong had less satisfying relationships, suffered more anxiety and depression, and leaned more heavily on substance use during COVID-19. The researchers noted that 1/5 of the participants in the study had decided to move in together because of the pandemic, which had made them less anxious generally, but also made the relationship less stable. When people could not meet in person, the famous felt like friends. A University of San Diego study found that as the social distancing measures went on, people maintained stable relationships with friends, but felt much closer to the celebrities they liked. Researchers theorized this closeness might partly be the result of people consuming a lot more content in their homes through their personal devices. Oddly, the feeling of closeness was not just with stars. It included fictional characters. Five resilience-building habits seemed to help couples soldier on. According to the School of Relationship Science, known as Communication Theory of Resilience, couples who focus on certain habits can weather hard times better. The techniques are maintaining a semblance of normality with routines, talking to spouses as well as sympathetic others about their concerns, reminding themselves of who they are and what they believe, reframing their situation in a more positive or different way, and focusing on how good things will be when the crisis is over. A University of Utah study surveyed 561 people to ascertain whether couples who used those strategies were getting on with their partners better during the pandemic, and found they did. The study also found that humor helped couples cope with the lockdown, although it did not always improve marital harmony. Time off television. Here's an essay, and it will be slightly abbreviated, by Judy Berman, Ted Lasso, LASSO, and TV's Strange Quest to Build a Perfect Man. Ted Lasso was either TV's most or least surprising breakout hit of 2020. On one hand, it was a sitcom adapted from a series of commercials and debuting on the relatively overlooked Apple TV Plus platform. But it was also a sweet soccer comedy with a recognizable star, co-creator Jason Sudeikis, that arrived at a mid-lockdown moment when the demand for comfort viewing and sports content was surging. The combination proved irresistible. Instead of disappearing on Apple TV+, it built word-of-mouth momentum to become the service's first big hit. Sudeikis won a Golden Globe for his performance as an American football coach imported to helm an English Premier League team, and the show recently scored 20 Emmy nominations. Fans, critics, and awards voters all seem to be responding to the show's fundamental decency. Here was a comedy about a straight white man's man immersed in the heterosexual, homosocial world of pro sports, who is also thoughtful, nurturing, kind. The crisis in male identity that's been escalating for the past half century has had a profound effect on depictions of men in pop culture. For socially conscious creators, the increasingly common association of masculinity with misogyny and sexual misconduct presents a problem. How do you write a male character, especially one who's straight, white, and cisgender, who's likable, relatable, and maybe even aspirational for the typical viewer who shares his identity, without making the guy odious to everyone who doesn't? Ted Lasso, which returns for a second season, July 23, solves this by making its protagonist a sort of happy-go-lucky fantasy creature, the kind of magical role model usually confined to children's stories. Ted's hardly the only idealized male specimen in entertainment made for grown-ups, of course, but I've never seen another fictional character who seems so deliberately constructed to teach other adult men how to behave in the world. Turning now to the world's greatest places, 2021, according to Time Magazine. I won't read them all, but we'll begin with Edinburgh. The historic Scottish capital is welcoming visitors back with a wealth of new establishments. The Gleneagles Hotel Group is set to launch its first city hotel this fall, Gleneagles Townhouse, with 33 rooms, a roof terrace, and a members' club. Recently opened on the former site of a renowned brewery, Contemporary Hotel Moxie, Edinburgh Fountain Bridge, features a rooftop bar overlooking the city's historic castle and a built-in cinema, and a new fine dining restaurant, Lalique, an hour's drive from the city at Scotland's oldest working distillery, the Glenturret, launched in July and will be helmed by Michelin star-winning chef Mark Donald, and feature whiskey as a key ingredient in its contemporary Scottish cuisine. Madeline Roche wrote that, and Rebecca Katzman writes this, Cairo, New Vantages on Unique Treasures. After 10 years of delay and anticipation, and the pandemic's decimation of the vital national tourism economy, the Grand Egyptian Museum, GEM, is finally scheduled to open this year in Giza. A state-of-the-art architectural marvel of glass and concrete, GEM will become the largest archaeological museum in the world, with more than 100,000 ancient artifacts, including thousands from the tomb of Pharaoh Tutankhamun, housed within its modern walls. In addition to GEM, perhaps they call it GEM, the Egyptian government is investing heavily in other projects designed to lure future travelers to the capital. The Al-Misr walkway is near completion along the Nile Corniche, creating a pedestrian-friendly outdoor space to check out the waterway. Also under development is the forthcoming Cairo Eye, EYE, which promises to be the largest observation wheel in Africa, expected to commence spinning in 2022. Elsewhere, the new St. Regis Cairo features a library room, spa, and floor-to-ceiling windows to make the most of the river views. Just 15 minutes from the pyramids of Giza, The Crown Plaza West Cairo Arcan is set to open with 187 rooms later this year. Houston, Lone Star Stunner. Houston, which welcomed around 100,000 new residents in 2019, has emerged as one of the most diverse cities in the American South. It also boasts a plethora of exciting dining options, including Musafir, which offers a menu inspired by two chefs' 100-day journey through India. Downtown, Post Houston, a concert venue, food and market hall, and workspace will open in a former post office this fall. Meanwhile, late August, a highly anticipated restaurant led by Top Chef finalist Dawn Burrell will soon open in the city's new Innovation District. Nearby, further cultivating the city's creativity, is Project Row Houses, a community-based arts organization that restored a group of row houses to provide art studios and exhibition spaces for local artists and affordable housing for young mothers. That short item was written by Kayla Stewart. Turning the page now to Savannah, Georgia. Revitalized riverfronts. The riverfront of the hostess city of the South is undergoing some radical changes, transforming underutilized spaces into new districts, bringing more of the city's hidden treasures into view. On the site of a former power station, the newly opened Plant Riverside District offers multiple restaurants, most with river views and outdoor seating, such as the German-style Riverside Beer Garden. Its towering dual smokestacks hover above music venues, morning mindful yoga classes, and the new JW Marriott Savannah, which features a rooftop lounge. About a mile east is Eastern Wharf, a 54-acre development that will include the Thompson Savannah. More buzzy openings include the Jewels, J-U-L-E-S, housed in a renovated 19th-century mansion on the historic district's Chippewa Square, and the Three Points Food Court, a food truck park that hosts yard games, movie nights, and live musical acts. Janine Clements wrote that, and Katie Lockhart wrote the next one, Maldives, an ever-changing archipelago. The Maldives was the first country to offer quarantine-free stays for anyone who's vaccinated. In an effort to draw even more visitors, it also has plans to offer vaccines to tourists on arrival, once all residents have had the opportunity to receive a jab, of course. And there are plenty of other reasons to keep an eye on these electric blue atolls. The latest man-made Maldivian archipelago, Fari, F-A-R-I, Islands, features restaurants, boutiques, and a beach club, accessible to guests from the island's newly opened luxury resorts, Patina Maldives and the Ritz-Carlton Maldives. The most extensive coral regeneration project in the Maldives can be found at the eco-friendly favorite Vela Private Island. And in 2022, construction begins on a pioneering floating city created to stave off rising sea levels. Next, Taipei, Culture and Quiet. Dan Q. Dao writes this. This year's slate of openings further burnishes Taipei's credentials as a cultural capital. Spring saw the debut of the city's National Center of Photography and Images, an institution dedicated to the research, preservation, and exhibition of Taiwan's photographic history. Meanwhile, the Taipei Performing Arts Center, with its striking architecture defined by a giant silver sphere protruding from one side of the building, seems set to become a city landmark when it opens in 2022. Another new arrival, Hilton's 175-room Hotel Resonance Taipei, which boasts a boxy black-and-white exterior designed to evoke frames on a film roll. Visitors looking for a respite from the fun and fast pace of the city can visit nearby Yangmingshan National Park, which was named the world's first urban quiet park in June 2020. And the silver spear protruding from one side of a performing arts center is shown in a photograph near this article, but it's only part of the sphere. They've cut off two edges of it, so we see only about three-quarters of a sphere. Napa Valley, California, Restoring Wine Country, written by Matt Villano. In fall 2020, Napa Valley, renowned for fine wine, farm-to-table restaurants, and laid-back luxury resorts, was devastated by California's record-setting wildfires. Though scars remain, the region's on the road to recovery. Wine tasting rooms are reopening, and two new high-end resorts will debut in 2021. The Four Seasons in Calistoga, the only resort in California built amid a working winery, and the 700-acre Stanley Ranch in Carneros, where most cottages have outdoor showers and some have outdoor fireplaces. Add to these the new restaurant Fleetwood, offering wood-fired pizza, and a new tasting room in a restored 19th-century mansion at Faust Winery, and this fertile part of Northern California is demonstrating its resilience as well as its trademark hospitality. Kayla Stewart writes about New York City back in business. New York City's back from its pandemic hibernation, and soon live theater will be too. Broadway is set to reopen in September. Art lovers are already taking in reopened or reimagined museums like Dia Chelsea, a contemporary installation space, and the Frick Madison's, formerly Frick Collection, new residence in the Breuer on Madison Avenue, a building previously occupied by the Met. New restaurants and bars like Harlem Biscuit Company, Sona, and M.E.M. Vietnamese Bistro offer creative menus and the opportunity to support BIPOC-owned dining. And dim sum favorite Cheng Fong is reopening in Chinatown. Moynihan Train Hall, a new 17-track expansion of Penn Station, brings the future of travel to the forefront, while heady outdoor offerings like the city's newest Hudson River Park, the Thomas Heathwick-designed, Barry Diller-funded Little Island, provide space for respite and play, and Kayla Stewart wrote that. Oyvind's Denmark, Fairy Tale City by Karen Burstein. An hour and a half by train from Copenhagen, Oyvind's is located on a quiet island with colorful half-timbered houses and crooked cobblestone streets. Hans Christian Andersen was born in the sleepy city, which this summer will see the opening of the brand new H.C. Andersen House. Designed by Japanese artist Kengo Kuma, the museum was designed with his famous fairy tales in mind. Exhibitions include experiential tributes to the tales. In a Little Mermaid-inspired area, for example, visitors can lie down beneath a glass ceiling to look up into a pool of water and imagine they're in the ocean. If traversing the magic of Andersen's stories works up an appetite, the nearby Storm's Pakhus Street Food Hall, a 100-year-old warehouse with stalls offering everything from freshly baked naan to fish and chips, is a decidedly contemporary counterpoint. Lake Khovsgol, Mongolia, Khovsgol, Untold Depths by Yulia Denisyuk. The little sister of Russia's better-known Lake Baikal, Mongolia's extraordinary Lake Khovsgol, has all of the beauty and none of the crowds, at least for now. At depths close to 900 feet, this astonishing ancient body holds about 70% of the nation's fresh water. A new airport south of Ulaanbaatar will triple existing capacity this year, and the plan to add nonstop Mongolian Airlines flights from the U.S. is set to make the Blue Pearl of Mongolia more accessible than ever before. A small photo is inset in this article. It's a body of absolutely deep sapphire blue water with an unending horizon, and people are climbing around a rock precipice above the surface of the water. There's a woman in the foreground. She's wearing a dark outfit, and she's just popping her sunglasses up off her face. A man follows her in a long, dark purple kimono-styled garment with an orange belt, and he's wearing a Western-styled hat on his head, not a baseball cap, but a more traditional hat. And there's a small child following him very closely. The child is dressed up as if for winter, with kind of a snowsuit on and a tan and brown and beige stocking cap. And then following that person, the small person, is another younger adult wearing denim with a baseball cap. So they're climbing through this really hardy-looking rock area. There's one more photo here to show with you, to share with you. It's 516 Aruca, A-R-O-U-C-A, the world's longest pedestrian suspension bridge. It is enormous. It traverses a very deep-looking gorge with rock outcroppings, boulders, but lots of vegetation, green and gold-colored vegetation. And that architectural wonder is found in Aruca, Portugal. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.